Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The wicked and wild roller coaster ride continues. COVID cases and hospitalizations spike. Markets are concerned, but not too worried yet. And getting artsy with our guest, Scott Lynn, CEO and founder of Masterworks. All this and much more on episode number 667 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we get together every single week and talk about all sorts of really cool stuff related to markets, finance, and money, and everything in between. I'm also president of Horowitz & Company, and that's an investment advisory firm. And the thing that's important to understand here is that we are actually in the trenches working this area of investing and markets. It's not a podcast from someone who's theoretical, an academic review of the possibilities. No, this is from how we see it, how we react, what we do on a regular basis for our clients. Well, here we are. It is Father's Day weekend, and I want to make sure that I wish everyone out there who is celebrating with their father a wonderful and happy Father's Day. It's probably going to be a little strange this year with, well, all that's going on. I mean, I know what I probably would have been doing if it was, quote, normal, right? If we didn't have all this requirement for social distancing, I guess, you know, it's going to be Father's Day light in a way throughout the day. Some early morning fishing going on and some social distancing with the family, which may not be the worst idea. Well, we'll get into that, depending on who your family is and all that. Some smoking up some short ribs, taking easy. But again, just have a wonderful time as best as possible, considering all the obstacles that we have right now that are in front of us. And to spend time with friends and family on this important day, take a little bit of a relaxation, maybe do something a little bit different. And again, you may be forced to do so either way. Now, let me get to a few items that I think that you want to know about, because, first of all, Mondays at 4:30 in the afternoon, we're doing the pop-up webinar Q&A sessions where you get the opportunity to ask any questions that you want. And we do a quick update of what's going on in the markets, and then we talk about money and take your questions on any subject related to finance and markets and money and your future and what's happening and things that you will want to know about. And no question, none. There's nothing too small, too insignificant. And nobody's laughing at anybody. Everybody's in this together. And what we're doing here is trying to put together a really cool educational platform on Mondays so that you can get the information that you need to make sure that you're making good decisions. So that's Monday at 4:30 in the afternoons, Eastern time. You need to register, so you need to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Top right, there's a little box there that says register for the webinar. So you can click that and register away and you'll be fine. Another thing I want to mention is that we have something new for this show. Let's try this out, see how it works. You know, you've been sending in your questions, the Ask Andrew questions, for some time on the site. You can do that still going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and clicking on it. But what I thought we would do is have a little fun with this and see if this works out. I don't know. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But now what you could do is, if you want to ask your question, we're going to actually put you on the show. Yep, you're going to be kind of a mini guest asking a question. So what you can do is basically go to a phone number, which I'm going to give you in a second, and you ask your question, and we will then put that question on the show, and I'll answer it in an upcoming episode. Sounds like fun, right? You get to hear yourself on the podcast and get to participate. more so than just me reading your question. So here's the phone number. I want you to write it down or put in your phone or whatever you do. It's 754-300-7095. All that line is a call-in line for, it's kind of like the old request line for radio stations, but it's like a call-in line just for questions, the old Ask Andrew section of the podcast where you can just simply ask anything you want. So 754-300-7095. I need a good amount of questions to get the first show rolling, which we're going to try to do and just see how this works out. So play along, will you? Find a good question. Think about something that you have on your mind. Maybe something that you haven't asked yet. And call that number. One more time, 754-300-7095. And just put your name on there, where you're calling from, and ask the question that you have. Keep it a little short, you know, under a minute or so, 2 minutes at the most. And then we'll have you on an upcoming show. So there you go. A couple of minutes of fame. I think it's going to be fun. All right, what else is going on? I guess the thing that I want to talk about here is the whole idea of the spike in hospitalizations and the COVID cases that I would say spooked markets a few times during the week. If you follow along on a regular basis throughout the day, I'm not talking about just start of the day, end of the day, but throughout the day, if you look at the charts, you know, you look at a 10 or 30 minute chart and you look at what happened throughout last week, there was a significant amount of choppiness, I guess that's the right word. And a lot of that choppiness happened after headlines came out about states like Texas and Florida and Arizona and, you know, the other ones that saw a very significant increase in new cases. That is one thing. And of course, we've talked about this whole nonsense about, well, if you did testing, if you didn't do testing, I get all that. I understand it's a numbers game. It's all about the statistics that you do behind the scenes. But the thing that I've been looking at, and I've told you this time and time again, that I am the most concerned about is the idea of the hospitalizations. If we see that hospitalizations start to increase, that's much different than just simply having an increase in new cases, because some of the cases can be, you know, symptomatic or asymptomatic. Some of the cases may, people didn't even know they had, or it's on the tail end, or we don't know exactly how this disease progresses necessarily. But one thing we do know, that if we see that hospitalizations, in other words, people that are contracting the virus become so ill that they need to be in a hospital, that's a real important factor. It's not only an important factor for the states and the hospitals themselves from a capacity standpoint and having to deal with things. It's a fact that we are seeing that people are getting deathly ill from this, and that is different than just having a cold or a flu or some kind of symptoms that, you know, you get over in a few days. When you get to the level that is hospitalizations, that's a big problem. I hope that we could all pretty much agree with that point. So the problem is that the area of concern here is that, and we talked about this last week, that governments are right now unwilling, at least that's what they're saying, they're unwilling on a state or a local level to shut down the economy again. They said it was too difficult, too problematic to shut down the economy, and it caused much more pain than would have been if we stayed open during all this. Well, now that we're seeing that the states are reopening and phasing in, some are slowing down and some are stopping their movement from phases to the next phase, we're seeing that companies are also taking a position in this. So on Friday, when we heard the news that Apple is closing down its U.S. stores in a variety of states that they reopened recently, that really shook the markets, because now the thought is, okay, well, we may not shut down the economy from a top-down level, whereas a state may say, okay, you know, we're closed. We may not see it on a local level, you know, in a city that says, you know what, we're going back to a full stay-at-home order, taking us all the way back to a phase zero. But companies may take it on their own to do so, and consumers and people may do the same on their own. And if that's the case, if in fact they're going to do that, it's the equivalent of shutting down the economy again, regardless of what the politicians say. So there's some concern that may be happening, where we see that On one hand, we saw the cruise lines were going to open. Now they pushed them back to, I believe, October, where the earliest where they're going to cruise from. I think, well, actually, September 15th is the earliest date that they're going to cruise on a from any U.S. port. And we don't know if that's going to be pushed back. We saw AMC Theaters, right? We saw the AMC Theaters come out with an announcement that they're going to be opening up their theaters and no requirement for masks. And a day later, they come in and they say, well, you know what? You're going to have to be required to wear a mask if you come inside. So it's a very fluid situation here. And listen, I got to tell you something. I'm a little bit spooked about one thing. And this could be just, I don't know, luck of the draw. But over the last however many months, I did not know anyone personally that had contracted this at all. Not anybody told me that, oh, they're relative than this person. I mean, I think back in maybe March, there was maybe one person. This week, two people that I know told me that their parents have it and they're hospitalized. Now, I'm in Florida, which is seemingly the epicenter of this next hotspot. And whether we're in phase one, I don't know why this big fight is going on about what phase we're in or what wave we're in. We're in wave one, we're in wave two. I don't know why there is such a battle going on about what wave. You know, they're talking about this is the continuation of the first wave. Maybe because we didn't see a significant amount of reduction in the overall cases. Maybe, so you qualify that as the first wave, and I don't know. Maybe because it wasn't that, you know, real drop. And if there wasn't that real drop and we weren't really ready to open up any, according to the best plan that seemed to be on the table, the phases where you had 14 days of no new hospitalizations or at least decreasing cases and slower this and less that, and then you can go to the next phase, and as long as 14 days you're there. No, they're not dealing with that. They're saying, oh, it's 14 days. We'll do it in 14 days. I mean, that's what's happening in Florida. There's no rhyme or reason how this thing is working. And they're talking about, again, a potential stay-at-home order for the Keys, and Miami's kind of stopping their increase or their movement through the process of phases right now. We may see that again, and who knows with what's happening in the area. I'm not even going to talk about Tulsa. I mean, the whole idea that a rally is going on with no requirement for masks or signing off that you may get ill, and the whole thing is, it's from a weird movie that you're just watching like, huh, what is going on with that? It's like the first time I watched The Purge, I'm like, what, who even thought of something like this? Kind of the same thing I'm thinking about the way that a lot of these governors and politicians are working. I'm thinking, who would even think like that? I don't even understand what a twisted mind comes into play when you're thinking that is the plan, you know? But, hey, well, we have to live with it. And each of us, I think, are going to take our own level of personal responsibility, hopefully, to what's going on and then deal with it. And the problem is that some people have less personal responsibility for others and some people have more. And I think markets are going to start sniffing this out. The whole point here is that markets are going to start sniffing out that there is the potential for a significant pullback by consumers that realize that, you know what, we thought we were in good shape, and now we're not. And this is what I talked about, and whether it was the second wave concept or the continuation concept, I don't really care what particular wave we are considering this, and whether or not we're in a recession or not in a recession, technically or not. The fact is, we know what's going on here. We know. And we're going to act accordingly. When I say we, I'm talking about consumers. And there's going to probably be a continuation of a slowdown. And that's why I talked about the U, or maybe these, you know, little bitty W's that go along and kind of smoothed out is a U over time. Anyway, with that, I'm going to switch it up this week a lot because I thought we would kind of get outside the area of just the stock markets and talk about something that is still in the world of investing. With our next guest. I think it's going to be kind of interesting. So listen into this. Let's get him all loaded up and ready to go. And our guest today is Scott Lynn, and he is the founder and CEO of Masterworks. Masterworks is a pretty cool situation because we talk about the whole area of investing in stocks and sometimes get into some alternatives, but I don't think we've ever had someone on that we could talk about really outside the range, which is the area of art and art collection and investing in art. So, Scott, so glad that you can come along today.
Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
So let's just kind of start off here and kind of set the stage a little bit. So Masterworks is what?
Yeah, so Masterworks is an investing platform that allows investors to purchase shares in masterpiece paintings. So very similar to how companies go public, we purchase paintings, file them with the SEC as public offerings, and then sell shares in those paintings. So it's a great way for investors to gain exposure to an asset class that otherwise they would have to spend millions of dollars to allocate to.
But this is it different than crowdsourcing?
It's different than crowdfunding in that we actually purchase the paintings with our own balance sheet capital, and then we sell them off to investors. And that's a specific regulatory requirement that we have to identify the asset before we file it with the SEC. So we're not really raising money from investors to go out and find paintings. We've actually purchased them and then we essentially present them to investors, and they can pick and choose which paintings they want to invest in.
So you've been doing this. I know you've been in avid collector of primarily, I guess, contemporary art, right? For about what, 15 or so years, and you've done a lot in this area. You've also had other startups that you worked with. What really got you interested in this whole area, and you know, then transforming it not only from your love of obviously art, but then into an investment, where you can make money from it.
Yeah. So I've been starting technology companies now for almost 20 years, but I've also been collecting art about the same time, and have an important kind of mid-century abstract expressionism collection now in the U.S. by artists like Pollock, Rothko, Klein, de Kooning, Frankenthaler, et cetera. And I guess to me, the thing that's always been really interesting about the asset class is that, you know, when you look at the characteristics, it's generally outperformed most other asset classes. We recently did a partnership with Citigroup at the end of 2019 to conclude that it was an uncorrelated asset. But there's not a good way to invest in it. I mean, the only way to really allocate to art is to go out and buy several $1 to $10 million paintings, which obviously most people can't do. So it just seems like a natural asset class that should be securitized, but nobody's really done it yet.
And it's interesting, you mentioned Pollock, right? Jackson Pollock?
Yep.
So from my days back in college where I took that art history course, right? You and I talked about, I always remember every time I hear the word Jackson Pollock, I think of the School of Flung Ink. Isn't that what goes along with Jackson Pollock?
Yeah, I mean, so Pollock is best known for his drip paintings. Those are important paintings in mid-century America. And the reason a lot of people, I think, have difficulty contextualizing that is he was one of the first artists ever that started painting in a non-figurative way. So for hundreds of years, you had artists painting people, painting things, painting landscapes, et cetera. Pollock and a group of artists like him were really the first time that someone started painting purely abstractly. So that's why he's important from an art history perspective.
I also think what's great about Pollock is, not to go off down this road, but it's kind of one of those things you're like, I think I could do that. You know, I mean, it's like, right, just give me some paint, give me some brushes, give me some gloves, and let me start throwing stuff. It's like kind of like the old days of Spirograph in a way. Obviously, yeah. He's a master, totally different thing. I get it, you know, but great stuff. You have some Pollocks?
Yeah, I have in the past. I don't currently own any, but I have in the past. Yeah.
So as an investment art, you said that it's one of the best categories. Is there any time frame that you're looking at that's really a holding period for this?
Yeah. So maybe you, just to take a step back and kind of break down the art market and then I'll answer that more specifically. So the way to think about the asset class, very high level, is it's roughly $1.7 trillion in asset value. That's a number that Deloitte publishes and some of the auction houses have confirmed. So to contextualize that, you think about art is $1.7 trillion. Gold, I think, is around $5 trillion. Private equity, I think, is around $3.5 trillion. And I always use this analogy for friends in venture capital and private equity, which is, you know, they're working with an asset pool that's $3.5 trillion. There's estimated to be roughly 6,000 firms that allocate people into private equity. You know, art's $1.7 trillion, and the only way to allocate to it today is with Masterworks. it's you know, it's really the largest asset class that people haven't securitized and isn't investable. And then when you look at the characteristics of it, out of that $1.7 trillion, roughly $68 billion a year sells. So think of that as a couple percent of your turnover. And then out of that $68 billion, and this is an interesting stat, roughly 62% of that $68 billion is from 100 artists. So these are household name artists like Picasso, Basquiat, Monet, et cetera. And they make up the vast majority of the art market. Very few of them are living.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like buying a house on the water, right? I mean, it's one thing that you have a house where you can buy a house anywhere you want in the world, but there's only a limited amount of water that's out there that creates a higher level of overall value that is, yeah, there's times that the markets will get a little wonky on you, right? But there's no more Picassos that are going to be created. I think we both could agree with that, right?
Yeah, and actually that scarcity dynamic is really interesting. It's one of the things that drives returns. So when an artist is living, they're obviously painting a lot of paintings, and they pass away, they stop producing work. And once that work is acquired by collectors then eventually donate it to museums, and it goes out of circulation. So it's one of the few asset classes where you have continuously declining supply, which does drive prices. Like, getting back to Jackson Pollock, I always like to use this example. There's something like, I think now there's 23-ish drip paintings in private collections. And out of those 23, there's only a couple that are considered A paintings. The rest are B or C paintings. But those B or C paintings are still selling for $30 million because there's nothing else left.
Right, you just can't get it. So do you actually go to the auctions and with the little paddles and kind of have the guy on the phone and speaking and whispering in your ear kind of thing to get these? I mean, how do you acquire these paintings?
For Masterworks, we acquire paintings both at public auction and at private sale. We're now, our acquisitions team is tracking around 600 different paintings at any point in time. And, we're acquiring a couple a month. So, we're really looking everywhere.
Is that all dependent on the cash that's coming in and the amount of money that you have to work with? Are you also utilizing core funds to make sure that you have a supply that's out there that then can be, it would be split up amongst the investors that come in?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely, the platform is growing so fast now. We're growing at close to 10,000 investors a month. It's been hard to keep up with the demand. Wow. So we sell $1 million paintings in less than a day. We sell $5 million paintings in less than 2, 3, 4 weeks. So we're really trying to add as many investments to the platform as we can as fast as possible. And I think a lot of that demand, in the current climate, is just being driven by people diversifying away from the stock market and looking for other alternatives.
Which, I mean, I always preach the whole idea of diversification. This is kind of a little bit different because it's not publicly traded, right? You know, it's not easily just in and out. But that leads me to the next question, which is, take me through the process. If I said, hey, I'm interested in investing in artwork in general. I don't know anything about any of this, right? I don't know anything about art, but I'm thinking, okay, that's an interesting asset class. That's the best I can, it's kind of like commodities. What do I know about necessarily oil or silver or palladium, right? But I want to invest in commodities. So same concept, I want to invest in artwork, and I have $10,000, whatever the number is exactly, and what's next?
Yeah, so you would go to the Masterworks platform, you would have a call with our membership team. They would talk to you more specifically about your portfolio, what your investment objectives are, and then they would effectively recommend different current offerings to you. And an offering to us, what you would really see is you would see the artist, you would see the painting, you would see the historical return for that artist market, you would see a historical return for similar sales, and then you would see a risk rating for the artist market that our research team risk rates. So, most of our artists historically range anywhere between 8 to 20% plus historical returns. I would say today, half of the artists that we bring to the platform are what we consider established living artists, meaning artists that sell more than $30, $40, $50 million a year in volume. The other half are kind of deceased blue chip artists who are selling in excess of $100 million a year in volume.
What would you rather have? As an investor, would you rather have a live artist right now or a dead artist? I guess it's going to be live, right? It has to be, because once they die, things go up in value.
Yeah, you know,
as horrible as that is.
it's a good question. So when we think about it just from purely a technical perspective and we look at historical returns, and then we look at the standard deviation of return or what you would think of as a Sharpe ratio, the Sharpe ratio on kind of the living artist category is about the same as sort of the deceased blue chip category. Hmm. The returns are very different, right? Like living artists, most of the returns are in excess of 15% a year. For a lot of the deceased artists, they're kind of 8 to 12% range. But obviously the volatility is much higher with the living artists.
It would seem to me that the living artists are those that it's kind of like a biotech company in a way, in that you have a living artist and if it gets really popular and then they die, it would be the equivalent of a biotech company having a product in the pipeline and then all of a sudden having that one be approved and it'd be a blockbuster drug, right? You know, whereas a dead artist, a deceased artist, the value just goes up because of scarcity and all that. It doesn't have any pop value as much. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. And I mean, we always get this question about, you know, will an artist's work go up in price when an artist dies? And it's not really it's not the event of dying itself that really changes the market. It's just the fact that there's no more work made. And then over time, as those paintings are donated to museums, supply is shrinking.
So I was on your site, and by the way, the site is masterworks.io, and somebody in your office asked me to mention that if you need to look at the site, you need to look at the disclaimers. It's masterworks.io/disclaimers. But on the site, there was Banksy, right? You have some work from Banksy, which is becoming, this is how bad I am. This I don't even know. I mean, it's a he or she. I don't know.
Yeah, he. Yeah, so Banksy's a really interesting artist. He's obviously living. His identity is unknown. You know, the reality is there's people in the art world that do know him. He's a little bit of I guess an outsider to the art world in that a lot of his work is collected by non-art world people, not necessarily established collectors. Very similar to Kaz, for that matter. So we think he's interesting for that reason alone. I mean, there's just a huge pop culture dynamic around him that we find interesting.
Yeah. I mean, especially if it's one day it will be revealed who it is, or, I mean, that whole mystery side of things, it's kind of like, when you have all these others that you don't know what it is, it creates a buzz. And he's been in the news a lot lately, especially now with a lot of the street art. I guess it's kind of street art, right? With the whole protest and all that that's been going on. So gaining some popularity, notoriety. And it kind of reminds me of I don't know, there was a movie about this somewhere, about the same kind of thing where you just have these rogue artists that ended up starting a whole revolution. But, you know.
Yeah, kind of cool. It's interesting. So we had a Banksy Mona Lisa stencil painting. It was an offering we did, I can't remember, maybe 6 months ago. And it was $1 million offering. And then 2 or 3 weeks after we closed that offering, which you may remember this, he had that Parliament painting that sold for, I think, $12 or $13 million, which really kind of reset his whole market.
Wow.
So now we've seen in our secondary market where people are trading shares in that original Banksy, you know, up 30, 40, 50% because of that sale and some of this other activity. But his market's definitely on fire right now.
So when I buy into this, let's get back to that process and how this works. When I buy into this, I put some money into it, I could buy shares, so I could buy multiple paintings if I want, right? I don't have to be in one. And there's a secondary market for that. So it trades like on an exchange concept.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically you can invest in these paintings and you can get liquidity one of two ways. You can either wait until we sell the painting in the future, which we tell people to think of that as kind of a 3 to 7 year period. It's very hard in the art market to buy a $10 million painting and turn around and sell it a year later for profit. You really have to wait in order to see returns on these investments. But if you need liquidity sooner, you can access our secondary market and sell your shares to other investors.
So now that painting, so I'm just throwing out a number and an example. You have, let's just call it a dozen paintings right now that you have and people are buying and they have a secondaries, but a lot of people decide to hold on to it and just sleep on it until it becomes more valuable in the future and maybe have that liquidity event where you sell it. Where are these paintings?
Well, we have a gallery in Soho where we display a lot of the paintings. Obviously, with kind of the state of everything, we that gallery is closed right now. But once we reopen it, the paintings are either there or they're in fine art storage. We're starting to work more and more with museums to put them on permanent loan, so people can see the paintings. And it's obviously good marketing for us regardless. But yeah, that's how we think about storage and display.
So a couple of things I have on that. First of all, to clarify, Soho is south of Houston Street and it's downtown New York, just a little ways away from Greenwich Village. As a matter of fact, that's where I spent my younger days. I lived out in the island. We took the train downtown, went to Soho. Back in the day, it was kind of the 80s, and I was kind of getting some really cool clothes, and you can go down, and there was on West Broadway down that way, which is Soho area. And you can go down there, and there's some really cool clothing places. You go to CBGB's for some really interesting punk rock music, and then we'd go to Chinatown, and for like $30, six of us would eat this incredible meal, and then we'd have like one cannoli and two coffees for another $30 in Little Italy. That's how much different the price. You know what I'm talking about, right? That's how different it is. But yeah, that was the back in the days. Every weekend we'd do that. There was always some great and visit galleries.
Yeah, our gallery's actually on West Broadway and Broome.
Oh, right there. There was a Think Big right down there, and there was what was the name of the clothing shop? There was like a really cool, well, they're not there anymore. It's changed a bit in the last 25, 30, let's see, how long ago was that? That was a long time ago. It was 30 years ago, I guess. Oh, terrible. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about some of the downside potential. Back in the, what causes a downstroke? Is it a recession? Is it like, what happened in 08 and 09?
Yeah, I mean, really, really, really good question. So there's two ways that we think about, quote unquote, I guess, downside. One is just correlation. How does the asset class correlate to other asset classes? And then two, what is the loss rate on a rolling basis compared to other asset classes? So in terms of correlation, as I mentioned earlier, we did a study with Citigroup at the end of 2019. It was really the first study on correlation between art and other asset classes. And we effectively concluded that art is an uncorrelated asset class. The correlation factor is basically close to zero between art and every other asset class. And there's probably a couple reasons for that. One is it is a global asset, right? You can buy a painting in the US and you can sell a painting in the UK. So it's easy to move around the world. It's not tied to any specific country. And then two, we think our prices are correlated to global ultra wealth creation. So the wealthier the top 1% gets, we think our prices will continue to go up. There's one school of thought, if there were sort of global policy changes that really change that top 1% dynamic, then our prices could theoretically change. The other thing that's really interesting is just looking at loss rates. Like what is the percentage of time that someone buys a painting and then later sells it at a loss. And we look at all this data all the time. We also look at magnitude of loss. And it's interesting, the loss rate on art is actually less than equities. It's less than gold. It's definitely less than oil. And the magnitude of loss is also pretty reasonable. So
is that because usually you're not going to, first of all, there's not a liquid market, so you hold it and you have a longer holding time, and the potential for it having tangible value. I mean, it's gold has it a bit more, which you can actually hold it, if you will. But a stock doesn't have any. I mean, it is in the company, of course, but it's an easily traded item. Whereas art, has the ability to be long lasting and appreciated, and people hold on to it for a long period of time. Is that why?
That's not why. So when we do that analysis, we actually only look at repeat sales in the art market. Mm. And maybe one thing that's important to understand is, since roughly half of the art market is sold at public auction, you have this massive data set, which makes it possible to really analyze the asset class. So when we're looking at loss rates, we're only looking at paintings that have come up and sold two or more times.
Oh, I got you. Now, if I was to go in and put some money into a Masterworks account and say that I put it in two different paintings, is there the potential that I can seriously go down to Soho and see my painting?
Yeah, totally.
Oh,
yeah,
and I could be big man. You know what I'm saying? I own this painting. I can say that with a straight face. I own this painting.
Yeah, you can tell lots of women that you own that painting.
Yeah. Wow. I like it. That's pretty cool. How many paintings do you usually have at the Soho Gallery?
It really depends on the size of the works, but only probably three usually at a point in time.
So now I could actually do a share of three of them and say I own all the paintings in this gallery. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
I could come in, I could rent the gallery out for a night maybe, have some champagne, and show everybody my collection.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I like this already. This is good. So what about the research that you do? I mean, you have a staff, you said, that goes out and looks, and you're looking at a variety of different paintings, and what's involved? I mean, and then I want you to add to that, please. This is kind of an obvious point, but I'm sure you're easily get to deal with this, is the whole point of fake versus, you know, non-fake.
Right. Authenticity. Yeah. So let's talk about our acquisition process a little bit. So the way that our team works is we have the leading research team in the art market. We really have the only research team that focuses on returns, surprisingly. And we had a group of 25 interns that went out, and we collected auction catalogs for the past 60 years, physical paper auction catalogs. Mm. And they identified every single time that a painting came up for auction one year and then subsequently sold later in time, and what the collector made or lost on that individual transaction. And that's actually what we refer to as our price database. So if you go on the masterworks.io website and click on price database, you can actually access this data and see it for yourself. But that's the data. So we identified more than 80,000 paintings that have been bought and sold and what the returns were. And that's the data that we use for index construction and to inform us on which artist markets are accelerating or decelerating, mm-hmm. And which artists we should buy. So then this year, for example, we've identified roughly 30 or 40 artists that we think are most investable in 2020. And we take that artist list and then we give it to our acquisitions team, and they go out and they find particular paintings by those artists at the best deals they can. So that's really how our acquisitions process works.
And are those always paintings that are for sale, or is that one of these things that maybe, you know, it's hanging in somebody's house in Monte Carlo and you send the team out? I mean, how does that work? Because if it's that part, I want to be part of it. I'm just saying.
I mean, it's both, because the way a lot of these intermediaries work or galleries work is, you know, we'll call up a gallery and we'll say, hey, we're interested in buying paintings by Alex Katz, and then they'll know where some of those paintings are buried, and they'll go after them. We don't really go direct to collectors at this point. Right. You know, that's a much harder game.
And does the very notion of having available funds, particularly funds that are in this kind of manner where it's an investment pool, we'll call it, just for lack of a better discussion, does that impact the pricing in a way that elevates the pricing for the good and for the bad?
I guess I'm not totally following the question.
So in other words, you know, you have, like, for example, we have price discovery issues in the stock market now because the Fed is pumping all sorts of money into all sorts of areas, and you have no idea. But everybody's like, okay, you know what? It's not going to ever fail because we have all this money that's flooding in. And you have other situations where a private equity firm may have just oodles of cash, and they're just looking to buy stuff, and they'll just buy stuff over price, right, with the hope that, you know, they can do something with it and hold it long enough to make the valuation. Then therefore the market starts to smell this and know about this. And especially when you have a market that's thin, where it doesn't have a lot of opportunity to have massive liquidity. What I'm saying is, by the very nature of Masterworks, having this money readily available to buy, does that distort the pricing in the market?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's an interesting question at scale. You know, right now, as I mentioned, you know, the art market does $68 billion in total transaction volume last year. So theoretically, if we were buying billions and billions of dollars of art every year, I think it potentially could. But we're a ways away from that right now.
So who can actually buy? Is it anybody in the United States? Is it worldwide? What's your reason? Yeah. And what kind of requirements do you have to have as a person to actually invest in this?
So these are SEC qualified offerings, meaning that both retail and accredited investors can invest in them. We do also have a Cayman structure for international investors that allows any profits to essentially be passed through to their local jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So we've really designed these investment products to really be available to everyone.
And what's your take of all this? I mean, you're not doing this for free, obviously, obviously everybody, you're in some way, you're sharing the profitability of all this, right?
Yeah. So our fees are very similar to hedge funds. It's 1.5% per year, plus 20% of profit when the painting sells. And then we earn that 1.5% by actually diluting the painting from an equity perspective, since obviously paintings don't produce cash flow to pay that fee.
So is there a high watermark on that, or is it per painting? Is it per fund?
It's per painting. So right now we really do believe in this structure where each painting is its own investment vehicle. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because we believe in secondary markets and trading securities in these paintings. But yeah, right now they're per painting vehicles.
So it's per painting. And then how do I, so let's say there's a catalog, again, I'm just using this as an example. There's a dozen paintings on your website that I can choose from. How do I know what to choose from? Except I know you have some tools on the website and all that. I mean, do you guide people? I wouldn't even know what to look for. Oh, that I like those colors. Frame.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So the best information to look at purely from an investment perspective is, what is the historical return? How do we risk rate that artist? You know, the harder thing to understand, and we, you know, from a regulatory perspective, we're not really allowed to give forward-looking guidance. So the harder thing to understand is, obviously, how do those appreciation rates change in the future? And you know, I think really depending on the artist, you can see kind of the length of track record that they've had. I mean, someone like Monet has been selling paintings for, you know, over 100 years. His market's more than $400 million a year in size. His appreciation rates are very predictable decade from decade. So it doesn't seem like his market's going anywhere. But that is the hardest thing to understand about this product, and probably, honestly, any investment product.
I mean, so I guess the point is that obviously one of the better things would be is, I mean, it's like anything else, right? Spread the risk a little bit, I assume, you know, because it is fractional shares.
Diversification definitely matters in this asset class. And in particular, when you're thinking about diversifying between living artists, because it's very hard, you know, for $1 million paintings, I know to a lot of your listeners, that sounds like a lot of money. And in our world, a $1 million painting still is not that much money. So it's very hard to predict with some of these living artists who's going to be the next $10 million or $50 million painting. Mm-hmm. So diversification, I do think is really important to the asset class.
So I want to get back to the safety of this, because this is something that I keep thinking every time I mention something, it keeps on coming in the back of my head. What happens when, I'm sure there's insurance or something, but you know, you're safekeeping this and you have a variety of different places that you're putting these things up and maybe even transporting them. What about the safekeeping and the what are you doing to ensure that these paintings, because of course a rip or a tear or a chip or that's not good, right? Getting out in the rain, somebody spilling something on it, coffee, not good. So what do you do to protect these?
Yeah. I mean, we do everything we can to protect them, obviously when they're hanging or when they're displayed, just based on, you know, where they are in the room and the orientation. But at the end of the day, all of the paintings are insured. For at least the offering amount. So if anything were to happen, investors would be made whole. But it's interesting. Like in the art world, art insurance is actually fairly inexpensive because there's very rarely issues. You can't really steal art because they're unique objects. So when you go to sell it, people would know that it's stolen.
Right.
Most of the issues really just come in with damage. You know, it's a kid who runs into a painting.
You're not going to a pawn shop with this and saying, hey, you know, what do you think this is worth? That's just not happening, right?
That's not happening, yeah.
So let's just finally talk about the end process of the cycle. So we talked about, you know, the different ways that you can look at the different paintings and pieces that are available and the idea of the holding period as well as the fractional basis of it and maybe looking at living versus deceased. Maybe different types of art, contemporary versus modern versus, I don't know what else we may have out there that you do, but what happens now, let's say down the road, 3 years down the road, I still got this piece, and my fractional share, are the valuations updated, let's say on a regular basis? And then that's question number one. Number two, what if I want to sell it and whether it's at a gain or loss at that point?
Yeah, so we have a requirement to do appraisals on an annualized basis. So there are annual appraisals, and then, you know, the appraisals may not track the secondary market. Like we're already seeing that. So selling your shares in the secondary market at that third year period would be the most likely the most likely exit. It's really interesting. Right now, 100% of our paintings that we've launched onto the secondary market are trading above the offering price.
I could have told you that. There's a lot of money in the system. Seriously, there's a lot of froth out there. That's a good thing. So I could, but I could sell it. And what happens on the sales? Is there a fee? Is it a price cut? Is there any penalty?
No, we're actually, from a regulatory perspective, we're not allowed to get in the middle of trades in any way, shape, or form, including charging transaction fees. Mm-hmm. So we really offer the secondary platform just strictly as a benefit for investors.
What about IRAs? I just thought of this. What about like IRAs, or can you own this in a retirement plan?
Yeah, we do support IRAs.
That's pretty cool.
Through a partner called Alto. So you can use IRA money for these vehicles, which is pretty cool.
Mm. Very interesting. So, I mean, obviously I would assume you have a pretty good feeling about the art market moving forward. Who's your favorite artist right now?
You know, my personal favorite artist is Clifford Still. And that's not a Masterworks comment. You know, he probably wouldn't meet the investment criteria for Masterworks, but, you know, we like lots of artists. You know, we've launched paintings by Jonas Wood, Alex Katz, Kaz, Monet, Basquiat, you know, lots of well-known sort of established artists, as well as lots of very hot living artists. Mm,
cool stuff. Well, I appreciate you coming aboard today, Scott Lynn, who is the founder and CEO of Masterworks. You can find all the information on the show notes for episode number 667 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as over at masterworks.io. Oh, so appreciate it. We're going to track this and see how this goes and see how the valuations track over time. I think it'd be a really interesting alternative for people.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Thanks. That's going to wrap it up for this show, episode number 667 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Have a great Father's Day. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll catch up hopefully with you on Monday at 4:30 over on the pop-up webinar Q&A, or the pop-up Q&A webinar. And of course, I'll give you that number once again. If you didn't get it on the first time, where you can call in and ask your questions, and you will be on the podcast. We're going to get your voice, your question on the podcast in an upcoming episode. Here's the number, 754-300-7095. Just call that and you'll be able to record your question. Until next week. Have a great one. Be safe. Make some money. And I'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.